Blog Talk Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Born to Talk Radio Show. I'm your host, Marcia Witeka. Conversation plus connection equals community. Those are my three C's. The heart of my show is, what's your story? It's my belief we all have stories. Some are similar, others are uniquely different. Storytelling brings the passions of my guests to life through our conversations. So be prepared to be entertained, informed, and inspired. Welcome to today's show. Well, hello, everybody. And you know, when you do live programming, anything can happen. And my guest is having problems. Oh, there she is now. Let's hope this works.
Hello.
Hi, Wendy. Can you hear me?
Hello.
Oh,
yes,
this is beautiful. Wonderful. Wendy, you know what? Life brings its own set of circumstances, and nobody would know better than you that that is the case. And so I am so happy you were able to get through, because we are live, and you are live, and I am live, and whoopee for us.
Okay.
So, oh, my goodness. Well, let me just tell our listeners a little bit about you. So Wendy is a retired clinical professor of social work and associate dean of curriculum development assessment at USC. She is the former chair and commissioner of the LA County Commission for Children and Families. She's written a book called The Youth Leaving. I'm so excited I can't speak now. Youth Leaving Foster Care. Plus, when you hear all of the extraordinary volunteer things that Dr. Wendy Smith does, you're going to be blown away. So thank you. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for being here with me. I am just delighted, Wendy, to have you join me.
Thank you so much, Marcia. And thank you for inviting me to have a conversation with you.
Oh, it's the best. So you do have a remarkable background between your roles at USC as a psychotherapist and private practice, I might say, for 35 years. Just tell us a little bit about your experiences in that.
Okay. I'll start with psychotherapy. When I first graduated with my master's in social work, I worked at family service agencies for a few years until I was licensed. And then I opened a private practice, which, as you said, I maintained for 35 years. While I was a clinician, I treated adolescents, individuals, couples, both same-sex and opposite-sex, survivors of child sexual abuse, and survivors of the foster care system. The majority of my work was long-term therapy, and sometimes I would see people 2 to 3 times a week. But I also saw people who were in crisis for short-term treatment, and usually couples counseling is much more time-limited. The people I treated had a wide range of kinds of problems, including anxiety and depression, panic disorders, eating disorders, relationship problems, obsessive-compulsive disorders, adolescent identity issues, and substance abuse. And then now let me say a little bit about what I did at the university.
Please.
Just after earning my doctorate, I started at USC in 1995 and ended up being there for 23 years in a variety of roles, really. I started as a teacher and professor, teaching courses in child and adolescent development and clinical practice with children and families. And then in the early 2000s, California started trying to build the workforce to help certain specific populations, and those included foster youth. So to encourage students to study those populations, they offered stipends, and schools needed to be be able to educate and train these students. Like many schools at that time, the USC School of Social Work didn't have a course in working with leaving care. So basically I was asked to develop that course, which I did.
Wow.
And then following that, I moved into a more administrative position. The first one was as director and then associate dean of faculty development, which meant basically that I was kind of a coach for faculty.
Mm-hmm.
I would work with individual faculty members on their teaching skills through individual sessions or offering seminars on specific aspects of teaching. And following that, I became the associate dean of curriculum planning and assessment. Every 7 years, schools of social work have to undergo a very detailed and lengthy process to maintain their accreditation. So really, this new position was about spearheading the two-year effort to do the study and evaluation for accreditation, which was especially complicated at USC.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because we were an early adopter of virtual education and offered one of the very first virtual programs where students all over the country could obtain their MSW online, doing their courses virtually and doing their field practicum on the ground where they lived. So basically, this accreditation study had to encompass the on-the-ground program and the virtual program. And frankly,
wow,
I think it was doing that led to my retirement.
Oh, it sounds exhausting. But, you know, if that
was
the only thing that you did or do, whatever, I mean, that's enough. But I just... I don't want to discredit all that you did at USC because it is remarkable and your practice. But your community and volunteer work is just sensational. I have such respect for what you do in that regard. And I know currently you serve as a board chair for the National Foster Youth Institute, NFYI. And I think that this is really exciting. I'd like people to visit that website, and I'll mention that as we speak. In fact, I can just do that right now. If you go to nfy.org, you will see the National Foster Youth Institute. And I thought what you could do is tell us about the NFYI and your involvement in them, with them, I should say.
Sure. I'd be happy to. Thank you so much for pointing people to their website.
Yes.
And that's why I was founded in 2012, so not that old, by then Congress member and now our mayor, Karen Bass,
right,
whose mission it was to transform the child welfare system by building a national grassroots movement that would be led by foster youth and their families. The NFYI is kind of built on the notion that truly transformative foster care reform cannot really be achieved unless the people who have personally experienced it are leading the effort to develop and change policy and programs. And interestingly, I was recruited by Mayor Bass because of my subject area expertise to be a founding board member. So I've really been with the organization since its very beginning. Mayor Bass and I knew each other because we've both been interested in foster care for such a long time. And fun fact, I was one of her professors when she returned as a sitting Congress member, no less, to earn an MSW at USC so she could be her own policy expert as a congressperson. So that was pretty incredible.
Yes, go ahead. Don't like go continue your thought process. Well, I guess I was going to say, you know, I know that she's our mayor. I didn't realize the background prior to being a mayor. So you just educated me something about the mayor of my own city that I wasn't aware of. So, I mean, she is really remarkable in the fact that you are your professor. But tell us more about NFI. And I keep saying NFI, but it's NFYI. That's the Y is very important. The National Foster Youth Institute, NFYI. So tell us more about it.
Thank you, Marcia, and thank you for clarifying that. NFYI organizes young people who've had foster care experience and brings them together in a number of ways. We have a signature event, Congressional Shadow Day, where we bring foster youth from all over the country to D.C., and they shadow their Congress member for half a day or a day. And really, those experiences serve to educate not only the youth about what it is to be a legislator and make policy, but it educates the legislators about the experience of the foster care system. And many of them really have little knowledge of that, and yet they're the people who are making laws that govern it. So that's our signature program. But we also have local chapters, of which Los Angeles chapter is the most active. And we have a National Voices program where youth meet virtually for listening sessions and educational sessions. And also we provide internships, which help former foster youth prepare for the workforce.
Let me clarify something with you real quick, because I apologize for continuing to interrupt you, but I'm wondering this, and perhaps somebody else is wondering this as well. So when it was founded in 2012 with Abbas, was it only in Los Angeles and then it became national? It's national now. Am I understanding that correctly? It's not just... It's something across this country.
It always was national in the sense that Congressional Shadow Day brought youth from many states. So it's always been national, and it's always been aimed at affecting national legislation and policy. It so happened that many of the initial members and board members were in Los Angeles, so that became in some ways a hub in the initial years. But our headquarters are in D.C., and we do have a chapter in the Delaware, D.C. area and in Michigan, and hopefully over time we will have a greater number of chapters in, you know, underserved areas.
Right, because that's really important. I think it's really important. And, you know, let's pretend that people that are listening don't really understand some definitions that are so obvious to us. So how would you define who a foster youth is? Who is a foster youth?
Start with who is a person in the foster care system, which might be or a young person. The foster care system is the last resort, you might say, for children whose parents are unable to take care of them for various reasons. Those reasons could be, you know, mental health problems. They could be addiction, but they in some way interfere with that parent's ability to properly care for their child. Often it's neglect, but that's a complicated category because often neglect is really a stand-in for poverty, and poverty should never be a reason for a child to be removed from their home. But I don't want to digress at this moment because I know you want me to explain what the foster care system is. So the government takes children into care if it's determined that they cannot safely remain with their parents, and provides at best the best end of the range of kinds of care is a foster family. But foster families are in short supply. So sometimes children are in group homes, you know, or residences that take in more than one child. And rather than being a family that they live in, there are staff who take care of them. And then children with high needs for mental health care might be in a facility where they can receive psychiatric treatment or substance abuse treatment. But basically what foster care is substitute care. It's substituting for family.
Let me ask you this. Please, go ahead.
No, I was just going to, in answer to your original question, when we're talking about foster youth, sometimes we're really talking about former foster youth, that is young people who've emerged from the foster care system but have aged out at 18.
Interesting. So you age out at 18. Let's say you are a third grade teacher at the local elementary school and you've become quite aware that there is something going on with Johnny or Susie. Something's not right here. And so you report that to the principal. The principal brings the child in with maybe some resources at that school, and then it's decided, Susie, Johnny, there's a problem in that home, a serious problem. That's what those bruises on your arm is all about, because somebody's been beating on you and it wasn't the kid sitting next to you. Does the city or the state or the community, does somebody step in and say, we need to remove Susie and Johnny from this home and they need to go to foster care, even if the child says, I don't want to go, or they, I want to go. Is that sort of the process?
No, but this is a great question, Marcia, because the process, your question leads us to the topic of what's called mandated reporting. That is, there are some people in the community who are mandated by the state to report if they see something where they reasonably suspect a child is abused. And teachers and school administrators are among those people who are mandated reporters. So if the situation you described came up, they would be required by law to call the Department of Children and Family Services hotline, where they would give that information and then somebody would either investigate the situation or reach out to the family with resources.
Thank you. That actually is very helpful. And, you know, as you say this, I'm reflecting on somebody that I know that actually, as you're saying this, it's bringing up memories, because this was many, many decades ago where this particular person went to foster care and then went from foster care to actually going to be adopted in that foster care home and was adopted by those foster parents along with a sibling. So I know that there can be from very negative, unfortunate circumstances to something that can ultimately save this young person. And I think it's remarkable that you do this. But this is just one of so many things that you do. And I thought we could change the channels ever so slightly, because I know that you're also very involved with the Venice Family Clinic. I'm familiar with the Venice Family Clinic. For those people that are not, you know, from this area, they don't know necessarily where Venice is, which is a community not that far from where I live in Westchester, which is Los Angeles. But what you do is you actually serve on its foundation board of trustees, and that's just another remarkable thing about you. And for those of you that are curious about that, and I will make sure that these links are available for people so they can learn more about them on their own. But the Venice Family Clinic is remarkable, and I thought you could spend some time talking about what you do there and what they provide to the community.
Thank you, Marcia. I'm happy to do that because they are a great organization. The Venice Family Clinic was founded in 1970, and its mission is to provide high-quality, comprehensive health care to low-income families and individuals who might otherwise go without care. I've known about the clinic myself since it was founded, and I joined the board, the clinic board, in 2006. Interestingly, like with NFYI, the way that happened was through a social work connection. I was at a continuing education class, and I met another social worker there, and it so happened that she was one of the mental health workers at the clinic, and she recruited me. Basically, like your catchphrase, Marcia, our conversation and connection led to community involvement. So
yes. It
was through her that I got involved with first the Child Development and Behavioral Health Committee at the clinic, and then eventually the board itself. And back then, both the behavioral health department and the clinic were much smaller. As you said, they're huge now. They have over 17 locations with multiple mobile clinics and an extensive street medicine program. And they have about 500 staff and 1,400 volunteers. And they probably deliver care to over 45,000 people. So they have just an amazing history and reputation.
They do. And, you know, for those of us that are active in the community and whatever that can, I happen to be a Rotarian, the Playa Venice Sunrise Rotary, but Kiwanis, lots of Lions clubs, lots of different clubs, they also do a lot to support this clinic. In fact, I think there was somebody from the clinic that used to be a member of our Rotary board, or Rotary Club. But, you know, just things that so many of us, and I understand, but there's so many of us take for granted that you just go to the store and you buy food and you have food in your house. But that isn't the same for everyone. And there are people out there that are hungry. And I know food is oftentimes, I think Bag It Up is one of those things where they just, there's campaigns during the year where food is delivered to the clinic to help those young people and families, not just those children, but their parents need to eat as well. And
right.
Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say along those lines, a few years ago, the clinic opened up a teaching kitchen at one of its sites to help people, you know, learn how to cook, too, who needed help with that. And as you say, they do also provide actual food to people. So, yeah, they treat the whole person.
It's interesting because I'm sure you have found through all of these years of doing what you do that you have young people that have not only come through the system, I think you mentioned this a little bit earlier, but actually end up coming back after education and being part of the solution where they once were involved in the problems of why they were there. And now they understand really well what somebody might be going through from a personal standpoint. That happens, doesn't it?
Yes, it definitely does.
Yeah, I think that's tremendous. And so in keeping with all the things that you do, I understand that you also serve as, I don't know, do you ever sleep? I understand that you've also served as a disaster mental volunteer for the Red Cross. And so what responsibilities did you have doing that?
Okay. Well, actually, I don't serve there any longer, but I do want to tell you about it because it's so interesting to me. You know,
okay.
I think most of us think of the Red Cross providing emergency shelter and food and help with the physical aftermath of disasters, which they do. But as we also know, when disaster strikes, it's not just the physical part of your world that's affected. People are traumatized by the losses that come with disasters and are terrified by them often. So the Red Cross also has a core of volunteer therapists who provide mental health services in the hours and days following a disaster. I became the assistant team leader of the West LA Disaster Mental Health Services, which I did from the late 90s to 2005. And I think you'd be interested to hear a couple of examples of the kind of
I'd love to.
Did.
Sure.
So, for example, after an apartment building burns, all these people are displaced, you know, who've had to be rescued and run out of their homes in the middle of the night. So the Red Cross obviously puts up a shelter for them, and then Red Cross mental health people go around and talk with them and find out what their, not only what their practical needs are, but how they're feeling, how they're doing. Are their kids managing okay? Often, you know, they're having nightmares or they're showing symptoms of some real psychological distress. So fires are clearly one of the things we would respond to. We would respond if there was a plane crash and relatives were waiting at the airport to find out if their loved ones had survived. We would talk with them. Also, during the period I served, 9/11 happened. So,
oh, boy.
Yeah, so the volunteers who traveled obviously went to New York. I did only local work because my kids were small. But we were called. I'm sure we all remember that morning.
Oh, yes. We all know where we were.
Happened. We all know where we were. I was getting dressed, listening to the radio, and then I got a call from the Red Cross. And I went to LAX. Why? Because the airline attendants who were supposed to go out that day were in shock.
Yeah.
And they were terrified of getting on a plane. So we worked with them. So that just gives you an idea of the kind of ways the Red Cross could respond to psychological disaster, right?
Right. Well, you know, something that we experience here on the West Coast that we don't experience on the East Coast is when we've had serious earthquakes where, you know, and you know, I mean, you said 9/11. Anyone that's of a certain age knows precisely where they were. I know precisely where I was that morning. I was walking at Loyola Marymount University with my friends. It's just miles away from LAX, and all of these helicopters are circling and circling and circling. We don't, this is, we didn't have, I don't even know if we had cell phones back then. I mean, maybe we did, but we didn't carry them around like we do now, like a watch. And it's like, what is going on? But, you know, earthquakes are the same thing, right?
You're right, and I should have mentioned that. That is another kind of disaster that includes mental health work.
Yes, you bet. So there's that. So we've talked about the National Foster Youth Institute. We've talked about the Venice Family Clinic. We spoke about the Red Cross, but that you don't stop there. And we also mentioned SC, which is where this all started. You are also involved with Human Rights Watch. What can you tell me about that organization? I'm not familiar with the Human Rights Watch.
Well, I'm so glad to familiarize you with it.
Yes.
I think it's something you'd be very interested in. It's an international nonprofit that was founded in 1978. And what it does is to defend the human rights of people worldwide. They do it by scrupulous investigation and observation, like, for example, of the situation now in Gaza or in Sudan. They send staff members out who interview people, learn about possible human rights violations, or like in Ukraine, situations where torture or, you know, atrocities toward the civilian population took place. So they do these scrupulous investigations, they write reports, and they expose facts to the light. They don't take any government support, which allows them to be, you know, totally without bias in any direction. And so they are widely respected, and they have a lot of credibility. And when their reports come out, people pay attention. My involvement, well, my husband and I have been philanthropic supporters for many, many years. But more important for our conversation, I worked with an amazing lawyer who works for Human Rights Watch and who has spearheaded many of the changes in California laws that affect juveniles who commit crimes. And in 2014, she helped get enacted a really important piece of legislation, State Bill or Senate Bill 260. And what that bill did was to recognize in law the difference between juveniles and adults in terms of where their brains are, recognizing that, you know, advances in brain research showed that your executive functions of your brain are not fully developed when you're a teenager. They don't, in fact, fully develop until your mid to late 20s. So as a result of that, it became recognized that for people who commit crimes when they're under 18, there should be some, you know, way to recognize their youth when they come up for parole hearings. So they have a different kind of parole hearing called the youth offender parole hearing. Some account is taken of the fact that you would do things at 16 that you would never do at 30 or even 25. So when that law passed, and interrupt me if I'm going on too long about
No. This is so fascinating.
Okay.
You are so educating me and everyone that's listening. So please continue.
So when that law passed, Elizabeth Calvin, this lawyer, and a group of other advocates, other lawyers and people who are advocates for juvenile offenders, began doing workshops in state prisons around California to inform incarcerated people who might be eligible for these kind of parole hearings about what they were and what they needed to prepare themselves for. Mm-hmm. And so they asked me, as a mental health person, to do what we call the insight groups, in which I would meet with 15, sometimes 20 men who were incarcerated, and on one occasion we were in a women's prison, to talk about how to begin to think about why you committed the crime you committed and what might have been some of the factors that led you to do that, and being able to recognize deeply the harm you caused. That these kinds of you know, self-understandings were necessary for you to be considered eligible for parole. Because if you don't understand why you committed your crime or how harmful it was and what it did to your victims and your family and the community, you might not be fit to come back to society. Mm-hmm. So
that makes sense.
At one prison that we went to, which was what they call a supermax, where the people who've committed the most violent crimes are, it's called Pelican Bay. You may have heard of it.
I have.
And when we went there, one of the things they asked me to do that I really couldn't imagine I could do was lead a meditation with like 60 people who are incarcerated. And so I walked into this room and I looked at the 60 or so brown and black tattooed men in front of me and thought, how are they going to listen to this white Jewish middle class lady, you know, leading them in a meditation? And also, how are they going to even dare to let themselves relax? It's such, you know, an environment where everybody is always on guard. But
Sure. Amazingly
enough, a lot of them did, and did actually, you know, participate and even wrote us notes after saying that the meditation was great, you know. So that was a pretty remarkable experience. The other thing we did at that prison was to meet with men who were in solitary confinement who might have not talked with anyone outside the guard who took them to the quasi-open cell where they had what sunshine they had for an hour out of 24 hours. And they were in their cells, and we stood in the hall speaking with them, you know, also about these parole hearings. They were, many of them were people who had been in solitary and not spoken to other human beings for months and some for many years. It was
wow,
very sobering. Yeah.
Oh, I guess. Oh, my gosh, the stories you have. Let's talk about it. This could be a 2-hour podcast. When you were your experience, and you know, there isn't anybody that's listening that doesn't hear the empathy in your voice, because I do. When you were the chair and a commissioner on the LA County Commission for Children's and Families, what were some of the issues that the commission took up during your tenure?
Yeah, that's so much more, you know, uplifting story.
Okay.
I will say that something I never knew until I became a commissioner, and that many of your listeners might not know, is that there are 78 county commissions, all dealing with different services and issues and populations, like the Women's Commission, Women and Girls, Fine Arts, the Harbor. I mean, you name it, there's a commission for it. So
Okay. The
commission I served, I was appointed by Supervisor Sheila Kuehl from the 3rd District. And commissioners for the county are appointed by supervisors and are advisory to them. And the Children and Families Commission was created in 1984 at the same time that the Department of Children and Families was created, and it was really created as a kind of, you know, oversight body in a way. Not officially so, but some way to, you know, make sure that what was in a new organization and now is not, make sure they're, you know, staying on point with what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
So some of the things that I feel most proud of that happened during my tenure on the commission were creating an LA County Foster Youth Bill of Rights, where we partnered with the state, and the LA version really became the model for the other 57 counties, and it spells out all the rights of kids in foster care, because often they don't know what their rights are. And these have to do with things like privacy, medical and mental health services, freedom of choice about attending religious services, family visitation, all kinds of things that, you know, might be handled differently in different agencies and families if there weren't some uniform setting out of what they should be. So that was one matter. Another was creating the L.A. County Youth Commission, which is made up entirely of young people who've either been in foster care or been in our juvenile justice system. And they advise the board about services in the community that affect young people. And they like to say, and I think it's a good kind of motto, nothing about us without us. In other words, you know, they have expertise in lived experience, and that lived experience expertise really can inform all of us. Another matter, and a third thing I'd like to mention, was during COVID, I helped to make sure that all our social workers who go out on home visits and investigations were prioritized on the list to receive personal protective equipment, you know, during COVID, so that they were protected. So, you know, there are other things I could mention, but I think that's plenty.
Well, I mean, you know, we're going to be out of time before we even get to half of the things I wanted to ask you. So I want to ask another question because I'm not familiar with this. I understand there's a lot of discussion about ACEs, A-C-E, also known as Adverse Childhood Experiences. Could you define and just explain a little bit more about what ACEs actually means?
Yes, I'm happy to do that because it is so important and so many people are paying attention to it now. I'm going to preface it. I'm going to introduce it by just explaining what the three kinds of stress are, because ACEs are an example of toxic stress. And I think it's helpful to know something about stress. So I would say everyday stress is helpful to growth. It's things like doing something for the first time, like your child's first day at school or starting a new job. These are things that stress us, but also help us grow. And we need them, right? Because how do we develop without having to reach a little and stretch a little? Tolerable stress is more serious life events, like losing your job or failing a test or being bullied, where it really taxes your ability to cope. And basically, you need probably some help getting back to equilibrium, and that help usually comes from having somebody to share it with, like your mother if you're a child, or a good friend, or your partner. If you lost your job, you know how much better you feel when you get home and talk it out, right?
Yes.
The third kind of stress, which is toxic stress, is stress that exceeds a child's ability to manage. And trauma, like some of the disasters we talked about, those are the toxic stress. It could be a severe one-time event, or it could be a series of events or a chronic thing that happens to you, like child abuse. And but you can get through it and survive if you have an adult who helped, as a child, I'm saying, if you have someone who helps you process it. If you don't, it's more dire. So I mentioned stress because ACEs, Adverse Childhood Experiences, our really early life stress at the toxic level. And another way to think about them is that they're bad things that happen to children. That's why they're called adverse childhood experiences. So
that makes sense.
In 1998, a researcher named Felitti and his group did a big study of 17,000 Kaiser patients in California where they were able to show that if you had certain kind of adverse experiences, you were more likely to have health problems later. And the kind they looked at seven kinds of ACEs in two groups. One group was abuse, whether physical, sexual, or psychological, and the other group was household dysfunction, like your parent is mentally ill or is an addict or there's domestic violence or you have a family member in prison. And so people with one or more of these experiences in early life were much more vulnerable to bad health outcomes. That was the beginning of paying attention to ACEs. There's been another study in 2017. They looked at people, a more diverse group of people across 23 states, and they found that 62% of people had at least one ACE in their background, and a quarter of them had three or more. And they added the category of parental separation or divorce and neglect, whether physical or emotional. So now there are typically 10 ACEs, in ACE screenings. And I could tell you what some of the dire, how they affect outcomes, if you want me to.
I'd be happy to hear that. I just want to give you time to talk about your book as well. So just so that you know, because I'm looking at the clock,
okay,
and you have written a book, and I do want you to be able to talk about that. But I want you to finish your thought here because this is important.
I do think it's important.
Yes.
So in California, some recent statistics that I think give a real sense of the impact of ACEs. They showed that 44% of people had between one and three, 40% had none, and 16% had four or more. And it's those four or more where it gets very worrisome, because those with four or more are 12 times more likely to have attempted suicide, 10 times more likely to have used injectable drugs, 5 times more likely to have depression, 2 times more likely to have cardiopulmonary obstructive disease, 39% more likely to be unemployed, and 21% more likely to be below the poverty level. So you can see it's your health, it's your behavioral health, it's your functional ability in life.
Wow. Well, that sounds a little depressing. I don't want to gloss over it. But you have written a book, and I do want to give you the opportunity because you wrote this book some time ago, and I know you're in the process of doing another book. But your book was called Youth Leaving Foster Care, and I thought that it would be important for our audience to know about this book that you've written and why.
Okay. I wrote that book as an answer to the fact that when I designed that course, there was no textbook I could use, not the book I wanted, which would combine, the foster care system, development, mental health, programs for foster youth, and policy. So I decided I would write that book and put all those things together rather than have to just collect disparate research and articles to offer to my students. And that book did then become a text for that course for quite a few years. And I will say the subtitle of that book is A Developmental Relationship-Based Approach to Social Work Practice. And I do think relationship and development are kind of two touchstones of what's important. So, you know, Marcia, before I say a word about the book I'm working on now, you had asked me in our discussion previously about, and I'm thinking about your comment that was kind of depressing, about the human capacity to change. And so I do want to say something about
Please.
I think it would give us all a little lift. And that
yes,
is,
ma'am.
I do believe that we can change throughout life because we really have a built-in capacity to adapt and to change. Our brains have what's called neurobiological plasticity. That means in new situations, our brains can change when they take in new information. And that includes new relationships, new connections. And for so many people, especially people who had very tough beginnings, they developed ways of adapting that helped them survive in a tough situation. And those adaptations can later get in their way. Let's say kids who turn to substance abuse because they can't manage their painful feelings. And then eventually that substance abuse gets in the way of their having productive lives. Or even people who just develop a way of being avoidant of relationships because they've been hurt. And then later that causes their lives to be too isolated. They can learn to trust again and to engage with other people and the outside world. So I would just say the important thing is what happens next. It's not just what happened before.
Right. Well, you know, that you make me think about another question I was going to ask you, and I was going to say, so what do you think are some of the key ingredients to helping people heal from trauma? Because I know your experience with this.
I think that core parts of the experience of trauma on the psychological level are being disempowered and feeling disconnected. And so recovery really, well, first of all, it involves feeling safe. You have to have safety in order to begin to recover. When there is a safe environment, a person can remember and mourn what's happened to them if there is another person or persons to do it with. That's the other part. You have to have connection. You can't recover in isolation. You need someone who can kind of witness what's happened to you, be there with you while you kind of take it out and look at it. Because taking it out and looking at it with a caring, safe person allows you to name it, put words to it. These things kind of deflate the power of the experience. A lot of the power of trauma to keep us stuck comes from trying to keep it out of our awareness. And once you are able to articulate it with probably someone's help, you can see that, A, you've survived it. You're bigger than that trauma. It's something that happened to you and is not of you. So you've externalized it, which is also, I think, a key part of recovery. And the final stage, I think, of recovery is reconnecting with other people and rejoining life in the present.
Do you find, have you found in your experiences that these children that have gone through the foster care system and now they have aged out and they're over the age of 18, do they ever find that their biological parents have also gone through the type of training and services that have helped them because perhaps their parents were also victims of abuse growing up and they just demonstrated what they were familiar with? Do these children ever, do they ever reconnect with those biological parents?
There are a lot of parts to that answer, Marcia. I think that's another podcast. But I'll just say briefly, many, many children, even those who've been very poorly treated, want to reconnect with their biological parents, which sometimes is a good thing, sometimes is not. You're quite right that often these parents are people who themselves never resolved or healed from their own trauma and are unable to help their children. And sad to say, many foster children themselves have not had the opportunity to mourn and grieve that they need and should have. So we have a lot of work to do there, too.
But I would say, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Finish your thought. I'm sorry. I keep interrupting I wanted you to finish your thought before I asked you the next question.
No, you go ahead. That's
okay.
Fine.
Well, so if you're in a family and there's four children and you go to foster care, but you don't end up all going to the same foster care families, is there ever an effort to reconnect those siblings at some point?
You know, much more so today than in
Good.
The past. I would say it's not yet where it should be, but definitely it is much more the case, and that we did write that in to the Foster Youth Bill of Rights.
Wonderful. I'm glad to hear that. I know you're writing another book.
Yes.
Do you even have the title of it at this point? Do you?
I do have the title, and I'm going to tell it to you, although it is
Please.
A little bit of a mouthful.
Okay.
Called,
I'm ready.
Okay. The book is called Before Their Crimes, What We're Misunderstanding About Childhood Trauma, Youth Crime, and the Path to Healing.
Wow.
And it'll be published in fall of 2025, and it's based on the interviews I did with former youth offenders.
My goodness. You know, what I'm thinking about, I'm thinking about you personally right now. I think you mentioned you have a husband, correct?
Yes.
And, okay. And you have children. I mean, I didn't even let you tell us a little bit about your personal life. Do you have children and grandchildren as well?
I do.
Okay.
I have two children, two stepchildren, two in-law children, and five grandchildren.
Wow. Well, so what I was thinking about in these last couple of moments is balance and how through your life you've been able to balance all that you do on that professional giving, always available level, and how you take care of yourself. Do you do some yoga? Do you do some meditation? What do you personally do to keep that breath and keep those shoulders away from the top of the bottom of your ears and relax yourself?
Well,
they're not supposed
to
be earrings, you know.
My shoulders are up there a lot more than they should be.
Yes.
And full disclosure, I probably haven't always had exactly the balance I wish I would have in every direction.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, I do. I work out a lot. I cook. I read a lot. I take walks. You know, I do
Lovely.
Those kinds of things.
Well, I'm glad because I think that that's important, just so that you can continue to function at this high level that you do. And I think there's anybody that's listening can be so inspired. That's what I would say. They don't have to be you. You're you. But you can be inspired, anyone that's listening to this, to think, you know, what's a little something I could do? What could I do to help? Maybe it's simply making a contribution. Maybe it's just learning more about these different organizations and how somebody can be involved. But I would just say that you are an inspiration, my friend. And I am really delighted. I mean that. I don't have to say that. That's not me being polite. I'm sincere when I say that. And this has just been an honor, and I mean that too, to spend this time with you sharing what you do.
You are so kind. Thank you.
Well, you know, I think that it's important. That's why, you know, we all have to have a purpose in our life. And I look at that and I say, you know, do I know my purpose? I do. I believe you know your purpose. And I think that that's important when you can look at yourself in the mirror and say, you know, I know why I'm here. I might not do everything that I intended to do, but I'm on that pathway of making a difference. So I just want to say thank you once again, Dr. Smith, for spending this time with me. I think when that book comes out next year, we'll have to do this again and just see where we left off, because I could probably just spend hours with you. I would probably love to just take a walk with you and just listen and learn more about you, because you are truly that remarkable. So thank you so very much for joining me today.
Marcia,
it's been a pleasure.
Don't let us end without my thanking you for what you do and for the remarkable opportunity you give so many people to have these conversations.
Oh, that's kind. Thank you. All right, everybody. Well, now you have some things to think about and maybe some ways to be involved. And I will let Dr. Smith get on with the rest of her day. And I thank you once again for joining me. And I'll have you back with me again next week. Bye for now, everybody.